Hello and a very good morning. You're very welcome to the weekend edition here in Highland Radio with me, Greg Hughes. Coming up on the programme, a wedding planner to the stars joins us to explain why she thinks children should be banned from weddings. Will you agree? We hear renewed calls for a shark park in Ireland, not least given the increase in basking sharks off the northwest coast. There's a new documentary on how the Irish helped build London after World War II. We'll get the details. Sally Hall lost her son last year, and this week her family fulfilled his wish to enter the Guinness Book of World Records. It's a sad story, but one with hope. 16-year-old singer Jack McHale from Letterkenny's in studio to perform live for us. And there's another live performance later from the excellent Sandwaves. This and much more besides between now and 12. You can text me 086 77 00 555 or call the show 074 91 25000. Devon, wait to take your calls there. And you can also tweet me directly at Greg Hughes 2. Okay, it's great to be back. The weekend edition. I had last Saturday off, thanks to Barry White, who sat in and did a fantastic job as always. Now, you can also contact me on Facebook if you wish. Just search Greg Hughes and I should pop up there somewhere. Okay, we're going to have a quick look at what will greet you if you go out and buy your papers today, or indeed access them online, starting with the Irish Independent. Ed Sheeran is pictured on the front of the page. Of course, he entertained 80,000 fans last night in Croke Park and does it all again tonight. But on a more serious note, hospital food so bad it makes patients sicker. We read that one in four patients admitted to Irish hospitals is malnourished, and many lose even more weight during their stay because of the poor quality of food on offer. Patient Safety Watchdog, the Health Information and Quality Authority, will carry out unannounced inspections of 13 public hospitals to examine meals served to patients. But from what I've heard, locally at least, the food is up to a very high standard, but certainly HICWA looking into that, and rightly so. The Irish Times, again, Ed Sheeran, features pictorially on the front of the paper. Drum at odds with Cowan on meeting. This is the story of former Anglo-Irish Bank Chief Executive David Drum. He's expected to contradict evidence given to the banking inquiry by Brian Cowan about what was discussed at a dinner hosted by the bank's board. Of course, yesterday the news was dominated by whether or not he'll appear via video link or in person. He is certainly, the authorities wish to speak to him as it relates to the whole banking sector. He's currently across the water in America, I understand, so I doubt he'll be too keen to come back for that. But video link looks like how it's going to go. Fury at call to hike homes tax on the elderly is the front of the Irish Daily Mail. This is a story that the state should hike property tax for pensioners living in big family homes, says the country's top property economist. Ronan Lyons, a professor at Trinity College and advisor to DAFT.ie, suggested the state needs older people to downsize so as to increase the number of family homes in the market. So effectively what he's implying, it seems, is that if you increase the tax for pensioners and older people in big homes, they'll move to smaller homes, freeing up the big homes for younger families. I don't know what you think about that. The Irish Daily Star, Dr. Evil. This is the story of killer Graham Dyer, who wants to get a doctorate behind bars at the taxpayers' expense. The twisted 42-year-old, as he's described, who stabbed vulnerable Elaine O'Hara to death in a six-sex act, wrote a long and arrogant letter of demand to prison bosses, which is reproduced in the Irish Daily Star. The Irish Daily Mirror, Katie's knockout blow to sexist boxer. Furious, Katie Taylor yesterday slammed British boxer Billy Joe Saunders after he claimed women are there for sex. The Olympic champ 29 delivered a withering put down after the fighter said females should not get into the ring. Of course, Billy Joe Saunders was fighting last night, an easy fight for him, but he's over in Ireland in September, I believe, to fight Andy Lee, who is a good friend of Katie Taylor. So a little bit more inspiration, I would say, for Andy Lee to get the job done there. The Irish Sun, the 60 million euro man, 1 million to pay to see Conor McGregor. Conor McGregor has been dubbed the $60 million man after battering box office records. 1 million Yanks, as they described, paid €60 each to see him smash up Chad Mendes on pay-per-view. So that's an Irish man doing very well across the water in America. Okay, this is the weekend edition here on Highland Radio. Lows coming up for you, between now and 12 noon. So hopefully you'll be able to stay tuned. Two live performances in studio, as I mentioned, musically. We'll hopefully play another couple of songs as well. So we want your calls, comments, and requests, as always, to the show. 086 770 0055 if you wish to text. Even if you've never texted a radio station before, let today be the first time. We'll be gentle on you. You can call us on to an 074 91 25000. And tweet me if you wish at Greg Hughes 2. Okay, next up on the programme, we read during the week that no children at weddings should be a rule. That was the views of top wedding planner Tara Fay, and I'm delighted to say she joins us on the programme this morning. Good morning to you, Tara.
Good morning.
Controversial enough remarks, how have they been received?
Well, I think they were sort of taken slightly out of context, because I did, while I did say that, you know, that it was ultimately the bride's decision, in my view, when it got later in the evening, I thought children shouldn't be allowed to a later part. By all means, have them at the ceremony or the church or wherever the ceremony is, have them for photos. But I think that once it gets to sort of evening time and that there are adults around and adults drinking, I tell you, there have been more times when I have driven kids to doctors, to hospitals, where my team have ended up minding children, picked them up asleep from dance floors, from sofas, where people have tripped over buggies or car seats where they have just been abandoned, literally. Now, I'm not saying that is the, you know, always the case, but it's just, I think that people, when they're in a party environment, do forget that there are young children around. And I don't think it's fair on the children, nor is it fair on some of the other adults that don't necessarily have children.
So when you're speaking to your clients and you recount your previous experience and suggest to them perhaps your ideas, are they generally agreed with, or do people say, look, this is the way we want to do it, we're going ahead, allowing children to stay later?
Well, normally I would say if they are going to allow children to stay later, that we will set up a special room for the children, and we to always ensure that there is one, at least one dedicated, if not two dedicated people to specifically mind or look after the children. I mean, if there is not a family member who is willing or able to look after the children, if there is a separate person, either a babysitter who is brought in or somebody from the venue who only job is to look after the children. Because if not, it's just a lot of the staff as well, when they're serving hot food or serving things, you know, it is very difficult for them when they're trying to serve if there are kids running around. And it's also not fair on children because, you know, spills do happen, trips do happen, accidents do happen.
And what about those wedding guests who perhaps have their own children and wanted a break from it, perhaps for this celebration, and they're having to endure other people's children around them? Do you think that's an issue?
I think that sometimes is, but again, it's usually up to the bride and groom to make that decision and make that call. Now, I think the original comments were based on a survey that came out where it would be that children under 6 months old or babies under 6 months old should be allowed to go to a wedding. If that is the case, and I've always said it, that obviously new mothers do need to have the babies with them a lot of the time, that, you know, if it is a suitable venue, we can provide a baby room. So if they do need to change them or feed the babies. But one of the things, again, a caveat that I did say in the interview was that a lot of the time that if people are in a little carry cot, they put the baby in a little carry cot and put it on the ground, they tend to forget that people will be walking around the table. So, I mean, it's very much from a safety point of view that we would always, you know, advise people to have a room for children and babies where they are in a much safer environment. Plus, I also don't think that late into the evening it's fair on children to have to sit listening to speeches or, you know, be dancing with other adults around where they're not going to actually pay attention to the fact, you know, if somebody's swinging somebody around a dance floor, they're not going to be mindful of the fact there's a 3 or 4 year old in the path of their swing.
Now, obviously, you are a top wedding planner and you were asked for your comments as it relates to weddings, but we could be talking confirmations, christenings, sports, homecomings. Perhaps it talks as much to our relationship with alcohol as it does to individual events.
I think possibly you are right. I suppose from the point of view of weddings where they would be different to another type of social event is that it is such a long day. And a lot of the times it isn't sort of conducive or isn't, people don't have necessarily the choice of leaving children at home or with somebody else because maybe it is a family wedding. And if that is the case, I would always advise them, you know, this is 14 hours that the children are going to be there. Do you really want to subject them to that? Because, you know, look at it from the child's eyes. It's great fun being there for 2 or 3 hours, but after that, it does get a little bit tedious. So from the point of view, you know, that it's not fair on anybody to have a child up until 2 or 3 in the morning while the parents are off dancing.
Tara,
I think that's one of the things to always bear in mind.
Indeed. Sorry if I couldn't cross you there. Tara, just generally speaking, we're out of the recession. I know perhaps a lot of your clients are very wealthy, but are people digging in their pockets for a wedding planner to help their day go that bit more smoothly more?
I think one of the things that people tend to forget about a wedding planner is that a wedding planner is doing this every single day of the week, whereas people, we hope, are only doing this once in their life. So wedding planners primarily, while yes, they are able to create beautiful scenarios, beautiful rooms, and a beautiful day for the bride and groom, the most important aspect that a wedding planner can bring to a bride and groom's day is that they can save them money, not just by directing them in the right places, but they can avoid them making costly mistakes.
Okay. Listen, Tara, it's a pleasure speaking to you. Before we let you go, any massive celeb weddings coming up that you can exclusively reveal with us here? No?
Unfortunately not. But good night for trying.
Okay. Listen, Tara, thank you so much for joining us on the programme. Very interesting comments. Thank you indeed.
Thank you.
It's quite a bit of reaction to Tara and whether or not children should be allowed at weddings. The caller says, tell Tara to get a life, and she goes to some rough weddings. Never heard more bull. Another caller says, children should definitely be left at home. I minded my grandchildren at a wedding. Hard work. And there were other children who were just running wild. Very dangerous in a hotel situation. Strangers around all the time, and they were driving other guests mad, and the parents just did not bother. I so agree with that lady. Weddings are no place for children. Many parents don't supervise their children and are allowed to run amok. That's it a bit, isn't it? You go to a wedding and it's like it's a theme park for children as well. It seems that the parenting goes out the window sometimes. Another caller says, though, that people know how to look after their children. Thank God she's away. I heard enough there. Ban old people too. Long day. Hate that music. Could fall, silly woman. Not sure about that. And finally for now, morning, Greg, can you please wish the St. Noel's under-12s girls team best of luck today in Glenswilly, where they play in the county final blitz. That comes in from all family and friends. Not a house occupied in Mount Charles today, I would say. Everyone up supporting the girls in Glenswilly. Now, basking sharks, we read, can become big as buses, but they're nothing to worry about. In fact, they could become an iconic tourist attraction. Emmett Johnson from the Irish Basking Shark Study Group joins me on the programme now. Good morning to you, Emmett.
Good morning, Greg. Thanks for having me on the show.
It's absolutely my pleasure. Amazing animals. They're huge. We are hearing more about them. Is it because of the good work that the likes of yourself are doing in getting the message out there, getting the awareness out there, or are there more basking sharks and other such animals? Mammals. They're mammals, aren't they?
No, they're actually fish.
Fish? So, they're big fish. Anyway.
Largest fish in the Atlantic that we have.
Are there more of them about then?
Well, it's a bit of both, really. So certainly we're taking more notice of them. And we're doing a lot more, I suppose, study, and we're finding out more information about them. So that really raises their profile. But also there's more of them than there has been maybe over the last 50 or 60 years when they were fished or tiger fished off the coast of Ireland. So the population is starting to recover. It takes a long time because they're quite slow to become mature, about 20 years. So, you know, they're 20 years old before they, like a human, nearly before they start to reproduce. And they only have a small amount of live young. So it takes a long time for the population to recover from target fishing.
What were they being fished for, Emmett?
They were being fished for their oil, particularly off the coast of Ireland, their oil for a cosmetics industry, originally for street lights back in the old
really?
Days. I mean, most of the whaling stations, as would have been in Donegal or along the west coast, actually fished sunfish, as they called them at that time, or basking sharks, they would have used the oil and exported it. So it was a valuable commodity and a valuable resource. But I suppose our argument is really that they're still a valuable resource. It's just about how you use it. You know,
they're protected now, are they?
not in Irish waters, which is one of our campaign. They are protected in pretty much most other EU waters, but not in Irish waters. So they're just it's just something we would argue that Ireland is probably central to their life cycle of the whole species in the world, and we would see a huge percentage of the world's global population passing through our waters, and particularly past Malin Head, so it's kind of incumbent on ourselves really to do our bit and protect them and look after them when they're on our patches.
Such. They're placid creatures. Well,
very, very docile, yeah. Like a large cow in the sea, I suppose. Yes. And they feed on plankton, tiny insects in the water. They're very, very harmless. They're absolutely majestic creature when you get up close to them. And all we ever say is, don't be afraid to interact with them, but just respect them. You're a guest in their environment, and just make sure that you don't do anything sudden or anything rash.
Before I just go on, I have to go back to the start. How can these be fish versus whales? They're mammals, aren't they?
Mammals are whales, yeah.
Yeah. So what? How do we determine the difference between the two?
Mammals, they suckle their live young through milk. That's the main definition of what a mammal is. So you would have like a bat would be a mammal, whereas a bird wouldn't be. And then these are fish, so they don't suckle their young. And it's, I suppose, the way they breathe as well, that they don't have to come to the surface to breathe, whereas all of the whales and dolphins, they always have to come back to the surface to breathe air as well.
Well, you learn something new every day. Now, as it relates to a shark park, this is not something inland. We're not talking about corralling these beautiful animals, I presume.
No. The shark park, it's really a new concept on the kind of international scene. And it's something we brought over an expert from America last year to kind of help us to try and really make the most of what we have here on the coast. And one of the things that he suggested was the idea of a shark park. Now, it's not a most people would think of a, something to do with wildlife park-wise is something that you
put someone on Twitter suggested it could be a mashup of Jurassic Park and Shark Nandu. That's not what we're looking at here.
No. and it's certainly not something that we're, that you're looking to restrict activities.
Yes.
We're basically saying that, what people are already doing, the fishing activities, the, leisure activities, everything that's going on the water is obviously making the environment here very, very good for these animals. That's why they're coming in.
Is this almost before we discuss that more, is it almost like a backdoor to conservation, though? Because if you create awareness, if people enjoy these animals in their own environment more, it increases awareness. Maybe it increases calls for a fishing ban on Baskin sharks. Is there a two-tier approach here, do you think?
There's nobody fishing them in Irish waters anymore. But it's really, we're trying to promote the animals as a tool for people, particularly in kind of the more sustainable tourism. And we say that whatever activities are happening right now are good. They're obviously working because the animals are coming here. So we want to try and maintain that and keep it going. And really, it's not about what we're not going to do to sharks. It's about what we are going to do and really investigate kind of best practice and how we can kind of further conserve them and pass that knowledge on to other people in other areas, particularly the more developing countries where the animals are still fished for their fins, for shark fin soup in the Asian market. So there's that kind of international context to it as well.
So how do we progress these plans? Who needs to get involved?
Really, it's about the communities, It's about people who are working and using the marine environment, people who are out there every day, coastal communities all around the coast of Donegal. And I suppose we've focused mainly on the Malin Head or North Inishowen coast area because that's where the most sharks are. And really, we would like people to, I suppose we're kind of sowing a seed or putting out the idea there. We're flying the kite, see what the reaction is. What do people think? Is this something that they would like to, would they like to be associated with their community? Because there's no point in imposing kind of things on top of people. It has to come from the communities themselves. And it's something that they would need to, take on board. It's self-policing.
Take ownership of the project.
Take ownership.
And think, right, this is about us, our community, our waters. You require that. Would it be then sort of like labelling it as a shark park and then having organised sort of excursions for visitors, that type of thing?
Yeah, potentially, yeah. I mean, it's a very, very strong marketing tool, and it's been used elsewhere all over the world for, particularly, there's a famous case, Tarka the Otter in the south of England. It was one of the first ones that they really marketed a whole area on a specific species or a specific type of animal that was associated with that area. And we think the basking shark is really a very strong symbol of the kind of wider marine environment, which Donegal is so famous for. And really, it's the best. I mean, we live on a little island on the edge of the Atlantic. The marine environment is our strongest resource. We don't have mountains to compare with the Alps or the Himalayas, but we've got the best coastline and the best kind of marine environment in the world. So why don't we sell that?
Yeah, I think very few people could argue with us. The coastline here is just absolutely stunning. Emma Johnson, keep up the great work. Thank you for joining us on the programme. And we'll see if this gets legs. I know it's not the first time you've mentioned it, but you get a lot of interest and then maybe that final hurdle that needs to be jumped, you kind of get stuck there. Do you feel that sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, it's there's two different ways you can do it. You can do bottom-up approach, which we prefer. Then there's the top-down approach, which is, going to the decision-makers, political level. But, really, that is you impose something on a community. And those people will fall into line when the community wants something. And so it's up to the people themselves. And it's a very slow and gradual process. So there's no rush here. You're talking many years down the line. And it's just, it's very, very slow, incremental. And we're very confident that people will come to it because it's sustainable, it's long-term, and it makes sense.
And very finally, just off the back of a couple of texts, you said they're not protected in Irish waters, but they aren't fished in Irish waters. What's the situation there? How does one rest with the other? It's just there's not a demand to fish them any longer?
Yeah, well, there's a kind of a moratorium, really, that because there isn't enough information on them, there's a zero quota, basically.
I get you.
Zero quota. But certainly once you go outside the territorial waters, the Norwegian fisheries still fish them quite a bit for their fins. The protection within Irish waters is really, it's quite symbolic in a way. But it's also to acknowledge our role, as I say, when they're on our patch.
Oh, humans are so selfish, such a large animal for just a fin. But anyway, that's it. We can only do what we can do. Thank you very much for that, Emmett.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you very much. That's Emmett Johnson there from the Irish Basking Shark Study Group. Might get a Basking Shark YouTube video up on our Facebook page. It's Highland Radio Hub, / Highland Radio Hub, which is separate from the news page. It's just a information page. So for Highland Radio, so if you have any competitions or bits of information or the radio bingo numbers, they're on that page and it doesn't sort of get all mixed up with the news and other types of things. Okay, have you any comments on that last piece? 086 770 0055 is the text line. You can call us 07491 25000. Yvonne waiting to take your call impatiently. And you can also follow me on Twitter, excuse me, at Greg Hughes 2. Or if you wish to search me out on Facebook, it's Greg Hughes there as well, and I'll follow you back and all that jargon. Okay, it is 23 minutes to 11. We're back with live music after this break. A texter says, I can't believe the basking sharks are not protected in Irish waters. Well, as I got the clarification there from Emmett, they aren't protected as such, but there's a zero quota. So at least in our waters, we aren't killing them, I suppose, for want of a better way of putting it. Jack McHale's just 17 years of age. He is a singer-songwriter from Letterkenny and joins me in studio now. Jack, thanks very much for coming on the programme.
On the boy.
Tell us a bit about yourself. Your love of music started from a young age, I understand.
Yeah, it did. Well, my parents really gave me everything I need to know. Like, I mean, they have hundreds and hundreds of CDs, and used to listen to them growing up as a kid. And then when I was around 10, my dad took me to see the Rolling Stones in Slane, and I was a huge fan already of them because my dad was a huge fan. And it just really put me on the track for music.
fantastic. And it was that it was like a light bulb moment. You were down there going, yeah, I see these guys up on stage. This is what I want to do.
Oh, it's just incredible. Like,
yeah. Here. So your influences then are going to be influenced by the music you were listening to as you were growing up. I think that's the same for a lot of people. But yeah. You're incorporating that into your own style as well, because there's a lot of you in your own music, of course.
Yeah. Well, like, I mean, I'd take stuff. Like, I mean, I'd listen to all my favorite influences and stuff, but
so give us a few. Eddie Cochran.
Yeah,
you've got a bit of an Eddie Cochran look going on, haven't you?
Yeah.
Otis Redding, Jimi Hendrix. So that's all of a certain era, but it's eclectic enough too, isn't
it? That's big for Eddie.
So I think any musician at some stage or other wants to put their stuff out there, but it's difficult. But what have you managed to get some stuff recorded, get some stuff released yet?
Yeah, I've recorded a CD, you know, like I was able to get a recording down in Claddy Media Studio, stand beside Gorda Hork, and I was able to get a CD recorded down there, and my girlfriend was able to get me that, and that really helped. Like, I mean, I got my songs onto a CD and stuff, and I'm gonna hand them out, try to get gigs and stuff.
But, yeah.
Like, it started, I went up to Busk in Derry, and, you know, being on the street and everything and busking, and loads of people come up to you and saying, geez.
You do that regularly, really, don't you?
Yeah, quite a bit. Like, I mean, you know, I need the money.
there's money in it too, isn't there? I mean, people are quite generous.
Good, yeah, I mean, the pound's good. Change it into euro.
I was wondering why Derry, I see now, yeah. When it goes the other way, you'll be in Letterkenny or Buncrana or something.
It could be.
But, I mean, people don't throw money at you for the sake of it. Obviously, you're entertaining them as well. But it's, I mean, you're playing to a live audience, so it's good experience.
Yeah. Yeah, well, a busk in between, like, Richmond and Foyd, like, and there'd be many other buskers, like, you know, and they'd share the spot and everything, and you get an audience sitting on the steps and then outside the cafes and stuff, and it is really fun. Like,
good stuff. As it relates to your CD, is it covers? Is it your own music? Is it a mix?
Originals.
All your own original stuff?
Only recording originals. Like.
Now, you talked about gigs. With you being 17, you're 18 in November, does that work against you at all? Or people open doesn't really make any difference? I know we get a lot of young artists on this show and they say it doesn't, but...
No, not really. I mean, like, it all depends if you're good or not.
It's more about, what is it, a football cliche, if you're good enough, you're old enough. Yeah. And do you use the social media, YouTube, that type of thing to build your audience, or are you working into that?
I'm working into that pretty much. You know, like, I'm waiting on these, Claddy Media is going to give me of digital tracks.
Yeah.
And so then I can put them...
Put it up at decent quality rather than...
Yeah, I prefer, like, decent quality, because I don't really have any recording equipment of my own. Yeah.
Okay, we're all tuned up, ready to go. Live music now from Jack McHale. Take it away, Jack.
Okay. Just a letter on the table.
are just a letter on the table. Just a letter on the table. And it's breaking my heart. Well, I didn't realize how much you meant to my eyes. Well, darling, I'm hurting. Yes, I know things haven't been the same, but it's been pouring down on rain. Well, girl, are you certain? You're just a letter on the table. Just a letter on the table. But baby, where'd you go? Yes, where did you go? Yeah. Oh, where did you go? Well, baby, I'm reading.
Absolutely brilliant, Jack. Fair play. You wrote that yourself?
Yeah, I wrote that.
Sounds absolutely brilliant. That's on the CD.
It's on
now,
CD.
People are going to want to know how where they can get hold of it. So what's the story there?
Well, I'm going to make more copies and then I'll get them out there.
Excellent. And that's what the people in Derry and those visiting get to enjoy. Jack, so thanks so much for coming in.
No bother.
Really appreciate that.
Thank
that's
you.
A name to keep an ear out for. Jack McHale, a 17-year-old singer-songwriter from Letterkenny. Thank you so much for that, Jack. Now, there is a new documentary from Die House Films. It's called We Built This City. It's a moving portrayal of the Irish people who helped rebuild London from the end of World War II until the present day. David O'Sullivan from Die House Films joins us on the programme now. David, good morning to you.
Good morning.
Fascinating story to work on, I can imagine.
Yes, it was. I should stress that it's quite a short film, and it was funded by the Department of Foreign Affairs and the Irish Architecture Foundation, and it's really only a 5-6 minute short, but the idea was that it was going to be it was used at an event in London, which was called We Built This City, and the idea of that event was just to get a discussion going about the Irish involvement in the built environment in London for the past sort of 60 years. And so, you know, they commissioned the short film just to kind of set off the event and put the whole thing in context. So the film, in a very sort of broad overview, has a look at the very first Irish after the war who were involved in rebuilding Britain.
How readily available was the footage?
Very difficult, actually, and luckily we had a couple of contributors, and we had to use a lot of photographs, and we sort of animated the photographs in order to sort of bring it to life.
Mm.
We have a collaborator by the name of Alton Cowley, who is probably the sort of foremost authority on the Irish Navy, or, you know, the men who are the Irishmen who went to build.
Did the Irish see an opportunity to get work, or was there a call for labour at the time? Do we know?
Well, what happened was after the Second World War, you know, Britain was in ruins, essentially, from the bombing, and everything from telecommunications and the sewage system and everything from the ground up had to be rebuilt, and there was a shortage of labour. There already had been an established pattern of Irishmen who went over for seasonal work in England for all kinds of things, and so they came because there was a call for labour, and they came from the west of Ireland, mainly from Donegal all the way down to Kerry and everywhere in between. from small farms where they may not have been enough work to go around, and some of those sons had to get on a boat and go to London, basically.
And in this short film, is it available for people to view generally, or was it for this project specifically?
No, it was for this project specifically. Well, anybody can watch it, actually. If they, there is a... if you go to the Irish Architecture Foundation website, you'll just search... it'll be on their main page. We at the event We Built the City, and there the link to the video.
Okay, well, we'll link that to fire off Facebook / Highland Radio Hub. For now, David O'Sullivan, thank you very much.
Thanks a million.
It's a pleasure talking to you. Alton Cowley's an Irish historian. Good morning to you, Alton.
Good morning, how are you?
Very, very well. So, can you give us an idea of the scale of the Irish involvement in rebuilding London and England generally, I suppose, post-World War II?
About 1960, there were 200,000 Irish working in British construction. And that would be a very small percentage of the labour force, which would have been pushing towards 2 million, I would say, in construction in general. But where the Irish... it was rather like, I suppose you could say, to use a military analogy, like shock troops. They were at the, literally the cutting edge in that they were concentrated in groundworks. They were there because they didn't want to be down a trench. They were there because they hadn't been given the education or the practical skills to be anything but unskilled labourers, by and large.
So to extend that analogy, the Irish then were sort of like first over the ditch, so to speak, well, in a war scenario.
You could say that, yeah. And this was at a time when construction was not was very labour-intensive. The technology wasn't there that we have today, and that's where they were able to make their mark, because it was absolutely vital. That's where you started off. You started ground level, even below ground level, putting in the services, laying foundations and so on, and they concentrated there, and they made an impression, they made a mark. They were also, as a result of that, highly visible, you know, so that Navy became synonymous with Irish Navy. But actually, 90% of the railway navies were English. And we don't know about the canal age excavators, the first navvies. We simply don't know who they were. They weren't recorded. I would say mostly they were local labour. So it's a big claim to say we built this city, let alone we built Britain. Of course, the title of my own book is The Men Who Built Britain, A History of the Irish Navy. So it's a little bit cheeky. But the irony of it is I never met an Englishman who argued with me about it.
But we had 10% at the very least. I think we can agree 10% of the labour force was Irish.
Sorry, what did you say?
10% of the labour force was Irish, isn't that correct?
10%.
Yeah, well, you said 200,000 out of a...
2,000, yeah.
Well, it's pretty significant. Did we go over there with a view to...
In one place at the same time, it's significant. If you were to dissipate them across the whole industry and all the trade...
I get you.
It wouldn't have been.
Did we go over there with sort of like, we're going to go over there for 6 months, we're going to go over there for a year, or was it an opportunity for a new life? Do we know what sort of proportion of people moved there and wanted to stay there and live their lives?
They'd been going over there for centuries. There were 200,000 seasonal migrants going to Britain every year to harvest crops for the English a century before the famine. It's a huge part of Donegal's history, migrant labour, seasonal labour, tattyhokers and so on. And they expected to come back. But in the 20th century, less and less of them anticipated coming back, although they believed in their hearts that they would. I'll go over for a while, I'll come back, I'll head home. But if you... you were expected not just to go over and survive with no skills or education. You were expected to send money home, which they aren't today. And the amazing thing about them is, given that kind of, if you like, moral obligation, I would say moral blackmail, so many of them not only succeeded in doing well for themselves there, but did keep people here afloat for decades. And they're an extraordinary generation and seriously underestimated in this new Ireland.
We hear of the stories, obviously, about how Irish were treated and the negativity in some cases. Generally speaking, how were the Irish received at this time?
There was never any prejudice in the construction industry itself. Men were respected for delivering, for doing the job. They had toughness, they had tenacity, and they had common sense. In the wider society, Britain was coping with, in the post-war period, with a huge wave of immigrants. And they were not a society that was used to this. It was a serious shock to them. And after the war, a lot of women had been widowed or their men simply stayed away, so they rented rooms. And four beds in a room in an era of full employment wouldn't have been unusual. But those people were simple working-class people, and they had the prejudices of simple working-class people, and they reacted badly. But then, if you have children, if you have dogs, the neighbours are going to complain, the other tenants in the house are going to complain. So, when you don't have any legislation saying you can't discriminate and you have to be politically correct, they're going to express themselves. So you've got no blacks, no dogs, no Irish. But by and large, I think if people were in construction, a bit like students today, they're going to be drinking heavily, they're going to go back, and as the phrase was in the industry, they're going to be damping the beds. And you have to ask yourself, how many times should the landlady replace her mattresses before she changes her letting policy? Right. I'm not excusing it, I'm trying to explain it.
Yeah, no, listen, there's no harm for a bit of balance and light and shade and all that. Listen, Alton, remind us of the book, please, that you wrote.
The title of the book is The Men Who Built Britain.
Okay, and people can keep an eye out for that. Alton Cowley, for now, thank you so much.
My pleasure, thank you.
Thank you, take care.